Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information. Welcome to another episode of Sea Dreams, the podcast exploring Southeast Asia and why it's the region to watch for the next decade. I'm Kenneth Nguyen, your host, and I'm joined by my other co-hosts, An Vo and Phil Van. And in this episode, we're going to discuss the status of cryptocurrency in Southeast Asia and why it's taken off there and who actually benefits from it. In the month following the November 2024 U.S. president election, Wall Street and cryptocurrency markets rallied on the news of Donald Trump's victory with Bitcoin, and alone, Bitcoin grew by 30%. And according to the 2024 Global Crypto Adoption Index, Central and Southeast Asia and Oceania, CSAO, led the world in crypto adoption and accounting for 7 of the top 20 most active nations for both centralized and decentralized finance protocols. So let's dig into it here today on Southeast Asian Dreams.
So cryptocurrencies are basically digital money that's kept safe through something called cryptography. They run on decentralized systems using blockchain technology, which keeps a record of all transactions between people directly without needing a middleman like a bank. You can buy and sell these digital currencies on various platforms such as cryptocurrency exchanges, neo-brokers, and neo-banks. These platforms are mainly online, offering easy sign-up processes without any physical branches, and you can access them through your phone or your computer, and they usually charge some fees for their services. We're going to dive into these platforms a bit more today and see how they kind of cater to individual customers and businesses. Some of the bigger names you're probably already aware of if you've dabbled at all in crypto are like Coinbase, Binance, and Robinhood.
How big is the crypto market in Southeast Asia?
Well, it depends on who you ask, but according to Statista Market Research in 2024, Southeast Asia would be pushing around about 4.6 billion USD in cryptocurrency transactions.
So just to give everybody a sense of, is that a big number or not really?
Yes and no, right? It all depends on what you're comparing it to. So comparing it year on year, for example, it's grown by probably around about 4.13% 2023 to 2024. The average transactions for Southeast Asian countries is around about $63, which doesn't sound like much compared to Americans, right, who are looking at an average transaction revenue per person of around about $9,500 USD
wow.
in 2024. Right, so we have to look at it in terms of both transaction volume, I think, and penetration of cryptocurrency within a country to see its real impact. Right, we Southeast Asia really can't compare in terms of USD value because various governments in Southeast Asia have adopted varying degrees of regulation around cryptocurrency and cryptocurrency exchanges, for example.
So we could easily go many different directions with this episode today with crypto in Southeast Asia. For me, I am interested in how it's all being used on the ground.
Sorry, yeah. Well, how would you transfer money from here to your family in Vietnam, for example?
There's two ways. The first way is that there are services that you could use, right?
Liga, Western Union.
Well, Western Union is kind of a newer player, but there's like all these old school Vietnamese, like you can go to their shops that you could go in OC or here, and you can just do it, and they charge like a percent or percent and a half or whatever. And that's like kind of the legit way, but you can't, there's
semi-formal and informal kind of transaction that works, right?
And there's also where like somebody in Vietnam, needs 20 grand here, and they have the money here, and then we need to move it. So then they would give it to my factory people, and then we would pay the family here. So that's an informal, very informal way. But now that with this crypto stuff, I mean,
before that, there's banks, or official bank-to-bank transactions.
Yeah, too, right? And that's a little bit, we're doing that now because we're legit, you know, it's funny. We're playing in a legit, you know, way, and we have invoices for things. But before that, we were just trying to build our factory. And 25 years ago, we would just do that. We would just go informal routes. We didn't have like an LLC there. We didn't have these corporate structures. But in crypto, it's all kinds of stuff happening, I think, in Southeast Asia that's very interesting to talk about. So that's one thing to talk about.
So you told me like 10 years ago you started doing crypto transfers.
No. Informal transfers between family members and stuff like that. Yeah. Because crypto for me was only 2017,
18. Yeah.
And then now like I have friends that need money. So I'll put them in touch with uncles and friends here that move money.
Okay.
But, you know, I was saying that there were a few ways that we can approach this episode. Mine is the man on the street, the average man on the street. I think for you would be analyzing the whole market, right?
Analyzing the whole market, but also looking at the approaches by institutions such as banks and whatnot, and also their attitudes by governments.
Yeah,
because it's a crypto everywhere. They're seen sometimes as a threat to the current status quo. Right.
And I don't know, Phil, do you have any sort of like direction you want to take this, or are you just along for the ride with this crypto topic today?
I think it's really interesting to contextualize it and see how Southeast Asia fits into the kind of global crypto landscape. Just as a point of comparison to like America or Europe, because everyone's sort of getting into crypto, right?
Yeah.
But where does Southeast Asia sort of stand? And just some basic facts, like Indonesia, I think, is leading the charge, right? Out of Southeast Asian nations, seeing this jaw-dropping surge in crypto transactions between January and October of 2024, people were traded over 30 billion in U.S. cryptocurrency.
That's 30 billion USD.
USD in cryptocurrency.
In Indonesia alone?
In Indonesia alone, yeah. That's
a lot.
That's a lot. And it marks a growth of over 350% compared to the same period last year. So that's a huge surge. But it's not just Indonesia. Like all of Southeast Asia has been bustling from July 2023 to July 2024. They processed 750 billion in crypto inflows.
Well, that's in USD as well.
Yeah, and you're all in USD.
There's so much to talk about here.
Before you go there, India, Indonesia, Vietnam, Philippines, Pakistan, Thailand, Cambodia account for almost 17% of the global cryptocurrency transactions.
And
that's huge.
And
experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
So Central and Southeast Asia are the third biggest crypto hub, right behind North America and Western Europe. So it is a really significant part of the crypto equation.
But isn't crypto, by the sound of it, is just becoming kind of like weird digital fiat, not fiat money, but it's like, I mean, what? It's going to be regulated in Southeast Asia because the way things are set up. I mean, why is it so important that
before we go there, you talked about initially the avenues that you took 10 years ago, right, in terms of transferring monies between countries from Western countries, the US, Australia, whatever, to Vietnam and Southeast Asia. What prompted you to switch to crypto, and how much is it now crypto versus normal traditional ways that you were using before?
Well, for me, I got out of the remittance, the informal remittance. Yeah. I've now gone to like between Bank of America to my bank in my factory in Vietnam. So we're doing things legit, but
for my friends who are in crypto, they're all transferring money through crypto, but it costs money to do that. It costs like a percent by these dealers.
So what attracts you? So why did you go from the informal traditional methods, if you will, to crypto now? Like, if is the crypto transaction fees less or more than the traditional routes?
No, I don't do crypto. My friends do it, not me.
Yeah. Okay.
And they weren't doing remittance. They're just converting.
Oh.
They're just converting. They're converting their... They don't want capital gains.
Yeah.
You know, you get hit with real capital gains with the... You know, Binance did a big switcheroo a few years ago, and they shut down all of international Binance. So Binance is a platform, and it shut down everybody's account. They're like, get your money out, pull it out. You got 3 months, whatever. Empty everything out. And now we have U.S. Binance. U.S. Binance is like Coinbase, where you're taxed on capital gains. And I mean, we can get into all that.
Yeah. Greater regulation by the central banks, essentially.
Yeah. How does this all tie in? How does the differences tie into Southeast Asia's, you know, currency? Like from crypto to just the regular currency on the ground, like the dong or the Singaporean, you know, currency?
Well, I think cryptocurrency is attractive to different people for different reasons, right? So on the ground, day-to-day, just Joe Blow's normal plebs, if you will, in Southeast Asia, in Africa, for example, many are unbanked, right? They call it unbanked. People who do not or cannot access through the traditional banking system within the country, right? Because they don't hold enough money, they don't save enough, they don't have enough documentation to prove their identity, or the physical bank locations aren't anywhere near them, right? And so those are the non-banked people. And for them, maybe cryptocurrency is an easier way, a less documented way to access money flows, right? Because all that's needed is essentially a smartphone.
Yeah.
Right? And smartphone penetration in Southeast Asia and Africa are quite high, given the levels of poverty, for example.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think the tsunami wave of digital banking has really serviced those unbanked people quite a lot. And with that, you have new forms of banking, if you will. And cryptocurrency is one of these new forms of banking.
So that's good for everybody, right? It's good for society, well, is it?
Yes and no. I mean, that's the unbanked people, right? Now, if you talk about business to business, international transactions, what would make cryptocurrency attractive there, right? Some factors of attraction might be lower fees, right? So maybe transferring money from, let's say, the US to Thailand attracts lower fees in cryptocurrency versus going a wire transfer, for example, right? It could be speed of transfer as well. They don't need to rely on banks to be open, right? Monday to Friday, it happens right away. Because it's based on cryptology and blockchain, for example, the level of security might be higher as well, right? Because it's all encrypted, transactions end-to-end can't be hacked, for example. It can become some in other ways as well, but generally that's what institutional kind of and big business tends to look for cryptocurrency as a maybe a better way of transacting internationally.
This all sounds like human beings, you know, when you think about the tendencies that you just mentioned, you know, security, you mentioned convenience, you mentioned lower rates of transfer. These are all like good.
Less regulation.
Yeah. These are all good things for humanity.
Well, yes and no, right? Because what does regulation mean? So, for example, if you do official bank to bank, you know, within the formal banking system, banks have to comply by concepts and principles and regulations around know your customer, and which is KYC.
and things like that, and anti-money laundering regulations as well, right? And so that can be cumbersome. That can slow down transaction speed, right? But it also formalizes, it connects with things like the taxation system, for example, as well, right? So if you do cryptocurrency and things like that, they kind of, one, they kind of skirt that whole formal apparatus, right? And two, the governmental kind of attitudes and impositions on cryptocurrency are a little bit gray, right? And so where there's gray, there's opportunity for opportunists, right? So, for example, drug dealers might make use of cryptocurrency versus going through the formal banking system. So there are pros and cons of this. And that's where I think a lot of governments and central banks are kind of wary of cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
And they don't know how to approach it. And so you'll see there's a mishmash of different approaches, especially in Southeast Asia.
I think there's also, it offers a way to protect against inflation to an extent, right? And political ups and downs. So if you're in a really stable country with a sort of a strong currency that doesn't wobble very much, you're probably not as focused on an alternative. But if you're in a country where the value of your currency could go up or down based on political instability, it seems like crypto's kind of a safe haven for some people. But that being said, I think there's a lot of instability in crypto itself. So I don't know how much, especially in the last like 5 or 10 years.
You know, but let me ask you something. If the instability, does the instability
or volatility
outweigh, like for example, in Vietnam, the inflationary, how do you say it in English? Inflation, like the price of the dong is going, like it's going down. Is cryptocurrency really something that could
hedge
inflation? Yeah, is it a big hedge against inflation? I mean, if you really rank the numbers and you go side by side comparison, is it really hedging it?
It depends on who you ask and who it applies to, right? If you're talking about cryptocurrency being a small or smaller percentage of the overall money flows, right? Both the official banking money flows and the cryptocurrency money flows, which may or may not be totally regulated, right? Then that offers a less of a risk to people and to the system itself, right? Because if there's a small proportion, people can access that and hedge against inflation, for example, right? But the larger and larger the proportion of cryptocurrency becomes as the overall within the overall economy, that kind of volatility and use of cryptocurrency makes it more risky to the overall economy, right? Because they're getting a bigger and bigger pie.
Yeah.
That's what the central banks are looking at and kind of wary of, right? How do they control and manage the risk of cryptocurrency and maybe slowly introduce it into the overall official kind of money flows that they're you know, by legislation required to manage and supervise and regulate.
I think also, cryptocurrency can go up or down with inflation, but it's not a direct relationship, right? It can be related, but it's more complicated.
Yeah.
Because it functions based on its own system of variables. Cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, for example, one reason they're a hedge against inflation, or they're seen as a hedge, is that they have a cap supply, right? So it's like 21 million coins will exist, period. Unlike sort of fiat currencies, which can be just endlessly printed by governments. And that cap supply creates value that, I guess, differs from the traditional sort of government fiat currencies. But the counter to that is there's still a ton of volatility in the crypto market. And it's because while typical inflationary news doesn't affect crypto in the way you'd expect, a bunch of other stuff does, like regulatory news. The government's regulating against or for against crypto. That can really affect its value. Technological developments, right? The ability to, like, you know, exchange crypto and have a digital wallet. and what all of that means for accessibility. There's also just market sentiment and a bunch of like macroeconomic trends that are outside of typical inflationary economics that seem to really a friend's trading in crypto over the years seems extremely volatile, but
but you know, how does it match the region's sort of like behaviors? You know, I don't want to generalize, but is there a big difference between the West and Southeast Asia, or Asia and Southeast Asia, or Southeast Asia and the rest of the world? Are there the uses of cryptocurrency and the way it's regulated and the way the governments in Southeast Asia, all of that ecosystem, is it very much different from the rest of the world? I think I'm out to explore, is Southeast Asia doing things differently and looking and approaching cryptocurrency differently from the rest of the world? Or is it all the same because we're all sort of like the trying to figure things out and we want to protect our money?
Well, it's interesting because I think about like personal examples, but obviously, I mean, you know, dad's from Vietnam, but he lives here, but he was basically unbanked while I was growing up. Like he didn't want to have a traditional bank account. He didn't trust institutions. His bank was like under the mattress.
Money under mattress.
Yeah. And I think he would definitely, if he was a younger man now, he would probably have like a crypto wallet.
Yeah, he seems like that kind of guy.
He would be that guy. And I feel like there is an appeal to a certain type of at least Vietnamese guy, like my father, right?
Because there's this distrust of central control, right, essentially. Yeah. And with the appeal of cryptocurrencies, that there is oftentimes less central control. So let's talk about central platforms, right? So there's centralized finance, or CeFi, C-E-F-I, where there is essentially a middleman, that's not the government, that facilitates a transaction between two parties, right? That's CeFi, that's Bitcoin, that's Coinbase, and things like that. You also see DeFi, which is decentralized finance, and that's much more peer-to-peer, and there's no middleman that kind of
regulates
and stands in place of a moderator or an umpire, if you will.
Yeah.
So, but underlying both of these platforms, CeFi and DeFi, is the blockchain technology, right? Which is, for those at home, it's essentially a very high-level digital padlock that kind of secures the transaction from one end to the other so that no one can break it and get in and then look what's inside, essentially. And so a lot of this cryptocurrency relies on this blockchain to work and to engender that trust, essentially. Because if you think about it, before cryptocurrency, traditional and informal methods is relying on trust, right? Trust in a person at either end, right? Or if it's the formal banking system, it's trust in the central bank or the central government to stand behind the value of the transactions, right? With cryptocurrency, it's just trust in the technology, which is an interesting change in the way we look at.
And that's why I think it works for Asia, for Southeast Asia. You know, there's a lot of reasons why. I remember at the height of all this in 2018, Vietnam was like one of the leading places that, you know, developers were like writing, you know, their white papers. They were coming out with all of these like blockchain technology, you know, companies. And it's like, I really thought about it at the time. I'm like, are people like your father, my dad, you know, when you lose something, you know, you lose a country, you know, and you're running, you know, you have this sort of like, it kind of like follows and lingers inside the culture. And I think blockchain and cryptocurrency, it kind of like feels like it fits with the Southeast Asian culture.
Interesting. Well, from
that's what I was hoping we're going to talk about today,
from a population perspective, though, like Vietnam and Thailand, all that, they're a very young population,
Yeah.
One, so that by not to say that every young person's innovative and flexible and adaptable, but generally, if you're younger, that you're more open to new technologies and adopting them quite rapidly.
Yeah.
Right.
What's interesting is just because not all Southeast Asian countries are the same, right? Certain countries, like maybe the attitudes you would see in a younger population in Vietnam, right, or Thailand, they do feel commensurate with like the kind of crypto audience in a way.
Yeah,
decentralized, like flexible, but
use solid. Of smartphones.
Yeah, use of yeah. smartphones, like not wanting a traditional kind of institutional banking approach. But other countries, we didn't talk about Singapore. It's interesting. Singapore, with its massive wealth isn't at the top of the like the crypto list, right? Indonesia beat Singapore. Singapore's doing big things in crypto. They have 1 billion in cryptocurrency transactions by the second quarter of 2024, but it falls below some of the other C nations. And I think that's because there's a certain conservatism to the way that their economy is set up. And the port of Singapore, as we spoke of in the Singapore episode, has a big sort of currency exchange built in because they have all these different nations coming through and they need to help sort of broker and barter cash trades. And they make money and percentages off of like helping exchange currencies. So crypto kind of is a threat to that a little bit. Mm. You know, so it sort of does.
But I do want to push back though. Yeah. I want to push back on what Phil just said.
Yeah.
Indonesia is one of the largest Southeast Asian countries. Singapore is the smallest. So does that have anything to do with the money?
Indonesia has 300 million people, right?
Right.
Around about.
Yeah.
Singapore, 285 Singapore has always been a...
5 million, no, always, 6 million.
A long financial center for the world. Right.
So could that affect the actual number?
No, but Singapore has always been, not always, but ever since the British occupation of Singapore, essentially, they've always been very regulated, right? The business environment is very regulated.
Yeah.
And I think at the moment, the Singaporean government's being very proactive in instituting rules and regulations around cryptocurrency.
Yeah.
They're much more formal,
more
institutional kind of approach to cryptocurrency. So in that respect, they're actually quite advanced within Southeast Asia in terms of cryptocurrency regulation and adoption.
And a lot of Singapore's sort of economy is almost set up like a banking system itself, right? So because they're so tied into big money exchanges and big business.
Yeah.
So for
big institutional investors and institutional companies, large corporates, that kind of formal regulation of cryptocurrency in the Singaporean way is actually quite good for them, right? Where you don't see that kind of demand, let's say in Vietnam, where it's more, you know, fewer, you know, lower people, right? Day-to-day laborers, workers, etc. But Singapore, the way they're approaching it is for big business, essentially. Yeah. So you can see this, you're starting to see this like...
pattern.
I'd also like challenge your challenge about Indonesia versus Singapore. I don't think the population size is as important as GDP per capita, right? And if you look at Singapore's GDP per capita, it's $84,734. And if you look at Indonesia's, it's $4,940 in USD.
That's a huge
with a great percentage of unbanked.
If you're making, you know, if your GDP per capita is $5,000, you have probably a higher likelihood of getting into crypto. In Vietnam, it's $4,300. You know, so you're seeing a higher GDP per capita in Singapore than certain European nations, right? Whereas in other Southeast Asian countries, it's super low. Like, it's well below the poverty line anywhere else in the world.
So is there an inverse relationship?
There is.
There's
brings me to a big question, which I think is fair to ask. Is crypto functioning in a way like a pyramid scheme for poor people? You know, and I'm not saying everyone in Indonesia or Vietnam is poor, but I'm saying that if globally you compare the GDP per capita, it is a poverty level.
Yeah.
And if the poorest nations are drawn to crypto the most, what does that say about crypto?
You know, honestly, Phil, this is actually the heart and soul of this particular episode for me, because analyzing and discussing this sort of relationship between crypto and regular fiat government money is a big thing.
So I think just to follow on from what your thought there, Phil, it's like, I remember back in the day, you know, early 80s or whatever, early 90s, people in Vietnam, for example, before the opening up of the economy, would be chasing US dollars.
Yeah.
Right? Trying to convert Vietnamese dong to USD.
Mm-hmm.
But that kind of conversion was controlled by the central banks and highly regulated, right? So you can see the attraction of cryptocurrency now for those who are unbanked or who are not part of the institutional kind of very formal big transaction type of economy, where they see cryptocurrency as a way to get access to this more secure, if you will, inflationary hedge kind of currency that is not USD, but is almost just as good, you know, Bitcoin or whatever it is that it be. So I think there is something there.
I also think, like, just human psychology, you know, you see like slot machines, you see like the lottery is played a lot and zip codes get pulled.
Huge gambling culture in Southeast Asia.
And I think crypto fits that. I think it's a gamble. I think it's a win big or lose big kind of equation for a lot of people. And I think people that have more and want more sort of stability in a more conservative and traditional
stay away system, from it.
They stay away from it. Maybe they dabble a little, but they don't really go. They don't go all in on something that volatile.
So is that why the central banks and the regulatory authorities in Southeast Asia are kind of slowly, cautiously, bit by bit, drip by drip, kind of seeing how they should approach cryptocurrency? Because there is such a risk for the lower socioeconomic classes within those countries to be burnt.
Honestly,
by cryptocurrency.
I think there's I think it is a pyramid scheme. Yeah. I'll go on record. I think my brother and I, we got in 2017, and we've seen multiple waves of this, and somebody's left with the bags.
Yeah.
Right? When it's pumped, you know, somebody's dumping.
Yeah.
And if somebody's dumping, somebody's like making out with all this money.
Yep.
It's just inevitable. It's just an inevitable pyramid scheme that's so complex that I think the bottom, you know, people are suckers, and it's just, it is what it is. Hate to say it.
Yeah. It's sad. It's sort of GameStop vibes, right?
Like,
it has the feeling of a pump and dump of like, there's a sort of, but among crypto bros, there are crypto conferences, there's a camaraderie, there's like, oh, we're going to all figure out how to get rich together. But in the end, there's a desperation to it.
But it's cyclical too. You know, it's a very cyclical thing, you know, like NFTs, right?
Yeah.
Like that was like huge a few years ago. 3-4 years ago, it was like massive. And then what happened to NFTs? It's completely gone.
So is the antidote to this fear that cryptocurrency is a pyramid scheme more education or not? Or is that irrelevant
maybe it's innate. Maybe your proclivity toward taking a gamble, especially based on your income, is sort of baked into how you're raised, your culture, your family. Or maybe it is just a lack of like an full understanding of how volatile this is and how much it can bite you. You know, I don't know. That's a great question.
You know, it's like going to the casino. Like if you go to the casino and you win and you 4x your money, 5x your money, and you have the control and the sensibility to say, okay, I got enough, I'm out. But that doesn't happen in crypto. Most people, they see that 10x and they're just like, oh my God.
Riding the wave.
They're riding the wave.
Yeah.
And they buy more. And then somebody in the back, like the smart guys, hits that bell and it's like this dog whistle. It's a very quiet dog whistle. And all of a sudden, your thing is worth nothing. And this happens every cycle, 3-4 year cycle. You know, the people who should be cashing out just should have cashed out, but they don't, and they lose all this money.
It feels very dystopic in a way, and I'll just say all the things that I actually think. It feels like it's a byproduct of late capitalism, where you see a lot of in a more volatile economy with like less of a middle, you see like a more high risk behavior to try. It's almost like more borderline criminal behavior to try to like make a bunch of money quickly, right? And there are more avenues for desperation really to play out, and a lot of it just leads to tragedy. And I feel like crypto is an example in many cases of that.
I agree with that.
So when you say this pyramid scheme, right? So who's benefiting? Who's the people in the background that you're speaking of?
I think there's a lot of people who are really smart and they write these white papers and they get a bunch of people to like buy in, and then a bunch of people buy in, and all of a sudden the dog whistle goes off and it's off to the races. And
so they're getting sophisticated investors to buy in.
I got caught.
Also unsophisticated investors to buy in.
Yeah, I got caught.
There's a dog whistle happening.
And then sophisticated investors get to pull out a little bit earlier.
Yeah. And I got caught in two or three of these. You know, not just me. It was like a crew of 15 of us. We like bought into the white papers. We were like all like gung-ho. We, like between the 15 of us, easily over $1 million in crypto at the time, worth $1 million. Because, I mean, each, if we look at it now, I would have had $2 million. My friends, these guys would have probably had $4 or $5 million. They were like, we were really into it. And all of it just vanished. These were smart traders, like really brilliant guys who knew how to like do this stuff, figured it out, look at the white paper they read, and nobody has anything. Wait,
you guys weren't sophisticated enough.
To pull out early enough and keep our money. But that's like the casinos, right? It's just like the casinos.
Feels like in a way it's like blue collar day trading or something, right?
Yeah.
It's a slightly less complicated.
Yeah, I'm so ashamed and embarrassed sometimes when I talk about it, you know, because if I just kept it right at the peak,
right,
I've had like 19 bitcoins. I just should have kept it.
But you're talking it from the perspective of a fairly well educated person in, you know, in the US, for example, right?
All the guys that I dealt with were very educated. Yeah, yeah. They were all very smart guys.
Can you imagine the ordinary Joe Blow? Yeah. Who's trying to transfer 600 rupee or, you know, 10,000 dong from one person to his aunt or whatever in Vietnam or Baht in Thailand? It's like, how are they going to know or have a view of the vastness of the cryptocurrency space?
See, and I think there's like multiple things happening. There's multiple elements here. That practical kind of money transfer, that's one aspect. The beauty of it, the beauty of crypto is that. There's also like this idea of like Bitcoin, 21 million of them, and it increasing in the value of like gold because it's the rarity of it. That's a different, that's a whole other thing. We're not talking about like, what are they, the small coins? They're called something. I forget what they're called.
White coin?
No, it's like the new coins, the baby coins. You write a white paper and then you get a bunch of people to buy into it. Mm. And it's not the same as Ethereum or Bitcoin or Litecoin, right? Those three are like the
gold
holy
standard.
Trinity, gold standard. They're like gold, silver, and bronze, right? I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about
the novelty.
The novelty coins. I forget what they're not called shit coins, but that's what we were calling them for.
Like Dogecoin, for example.
That turned into a big thing, you know? Because Elon Musk backed Dogecoin. But that's like going from obscurity to like you get a lot of eyeballs on it, people buy into it, and it just kind of stabilizes. It's very complex. There's not just one. I don't think there's one element of the cryptocurrency that we can kind of focus and say it's all good or all bad. There's so many different corners of cryptocurrency that affect Southeast Asia.
There's definitely an environmental component we haven't talked about, but just to Bitcoin mine, is extremely energy intensive and is arguably kind of reversing the course on any sort of environmental efforts. And it's funny because there's propagandistic podcasts that are really like Bitcoin positive.
Yeah.
And they do things, they'll talk about like carbon sequestration and like capturing useless energy from, I don't know, hot springs, you know, and channeling that back into powering these mines. I mean, but in the end, they're reopening like coal mining plants.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of works in, for example, in Australia, where there's lots of land, lots of mineral resources, things like that. It kind of works in the US, where there's lots of sunshine, right, to have solar panels to power these Bitcoin farms, if you will, mining farms. But Southeast Asia, like, where are they going to get the energy from to run these operations?
I don't know if they're running them locally. I think they might not be Bitcoin mining locally, but just participating in the crypto market digitally on an international level. I know China regulated against Bitcoin mining for a bunch of reasons, but a lot of that business came to America and is going to Texas. But we should talk about why it's energy intensive. I mean, to make like one Bitcoin, you have to basically just have servers burning for days on end, just crunching cryptography, like a really complicated code that no one can crack. That's the essence of one unit of this currency, right? It's basically just a code that takes so much energy to make, it would take even more energy to crack it. So you've got banks and banks of these servers, sometimes miles long, just burning through, you know, burning through the power grid or whatever sort of third party energy you can throw at them. I think in the end, that combined with new data centers for AI, it's just, I think nuclear power is going to be a necessity.
It's the only way.
I don't think solar panels are going to, or any sort of like reopened dirty coal plant is going to
power this.
This stuff.
Not even renewable energies, wind farms, hydroelectric.
I don't think so.
I think cryptocurrency, just like AI and just like some of these hyper energy intensive new technologies, they're all facing a wall they're going to have to break through, which is just that they've basically run out of a grid of energy. But you know, to do this, it's so dirty and it's so hard on the planet. Mm-hmm. It's a nightmare for anyone trying to like sort of reverse global warming and change, you know, reverse climate change. Like the irony of
you know, not printing money, not driving cars with gas, is that you need to burn a lot of energy to get to energy production, right?
In many ways, it's sort of replacing one devil with another. I mean, the electric cars are a different gambit, but I mean, the AI that powers the, you know, basically the giant computer system that runs like a Tesla is powered off of some sort of data center that's probably killing the planet more than the electric cars are helping it. On top of that, the cobalt mining is just, you know, just decimating whole communities in Africa.
In Africa.
And the level of destruction and just anti-environmental sort of tactics that these big businesses are making are undoing any good that we're creating. Not to sound cynical, but is it worth it? Is it worth it to have a new type of invisible currency that's completely decentralized? Are we not afraid of central banking systems?
But it goes back to poverty, right? It goes back to the question of like, there's so many people who are at the bottom, like in Southeast Asia, you know, Indonesia or Vietnam that have to use this because, you know, this is sort of like their best way to move money around.
Or to get all their money stolen from them when the market deals in downturn and they played their income like it was a slot machine.
I remember the name. It's altcoins, alternative coins. So we as a team had invested in so many altcoin companies and they all went belly up. And well, who took that money? Who took our over $1 million that we had in crypto? It went somewhere.
So Vietnam apparently has been slow to adapt crypto regulations, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think the government is wary, right? It seems like the Bank of Thailand is also taking a cautious but sort of restrictive approach.
But how do you even restrict it?
I don't think you can.
Can you?
Yeah, I don't know how a hyper-restrictive government can even get in and regulate.
Yeah, how do you regulate this?
Other than saying if we catch you with like
an app,
Coinbase, you're going to jail. I don't know. I don't know how else you would do it.
Well, it all depends, right? So
how did the US do it? How did they make, like, they kicked Binance out and then they instituted US Binance and Coinbase? Those are the only two, and Robinhood, major players that you can now do it, and then it's all controlled because if you sell, you get capital gains taxed. How did they do that?
Well, through regulation, right? So one is the US is the currency standard for the world. Right. So at some point, Bitcoin has to be converted into actual currency. More often than not, it's more likely that it'll be converted to US dollars. Right. So by the mere fact that so much money has been converted from Bitcoin, for example, into US dollars, that will be visible to the US central bank and to other regulatory authorities in the US. Right. So there's that. With the banking system, the SEC and things like that, they require anti-money laundering and know your customer protocols. So that's another way to control and rein in that kind of.
Why can't these Southeast Asian countries do it? They regulate and control a lot of things. Why can't they do that? They did what they did in the U.S. It's like crazy.
They can, but the thing is, you're looking at expertise,
right? And size, right? The size or the size of the workforce for the U.S. regulatory bodies is much more than, let's say, Vietnam or
it's more robust
and more robust as well, right? So there's that. I think there is maybe a strategic play by some of the Southeast Asian governments to, I wouldn't say turn a blind eye, but in taking a cautious approach and allowing, for example, the mom and pop people to transact on cryptocurrency, to exchange and to do remittances, versus being quiet or silent and not formally approving of large money transactions by corporations or institutions, that kind of allows them to figure out the space over a longer period of time to see how it would fit in with the normal banking system, right? So I think that there's a strategic play there. And each Southeast Asian country, indeed any Asian around the world, is taking that kind of approach. It's like it's like one of those hodgepodge experimental things, right? One country would do experiment with this way, another country would experiment another way, and hopefully they look at each other and say, what's the best approach?
They're all trying to run it through the regulatory systems. It's interesting to just drop in on a country we haven't talked about, the Philippines, basically is just trying to use their version of the Security and Exchange Commission's to try to regulate the crypto flow. They also have, I guess, a commission called KYC, Know Your Customer, and an anti-money laundering commission is required to just sort of address the risks and protect investors. And the Philippine Central Bank has issued the sort of mandates that are requiring customers and to report suspicious cryptocurrency transactions, which is an attempt, again, at sort of regulating all this. But I just think there's so much going on outside of the banking system entirely, right? And just on private apps in these digital wallets that, like, how does any of this actually...
Yeah, like An said, you need robust regulatory commissions.
And expertise.
Expertise, and you need enforcing.
Yeah.
Because you can come out with all these rules all you want, you turn blue, but if you have nobody to enforce this, and I think the U.S. can actually do what they say. You know, like, if you're selling and you're not paying capital gains, they go in and they just drain your bank account. They go in and they just go through your banks, and then they just duck your money. They can do that. But I don't think they can do that yet in Southeast Asia.
No, but the thing is, I think with, I'd say, the majority of cryptocurrencies are trying to gain legitimacy, right? And in order to gain legitimacy, they have to be accepted by the central banks.
Right? So ironic.
Yeah. I mean, yes, it is, right? The initial appeal of cryptocurrency was that it was off-grid and outside the banking system. But to gain legitimacy and to gain acceptance and greater usage, I think they have to abide by the regulations that are put forth and brought about by the central banks in some future point in time. It's just very interesting, the hodgepodge approach, you see. So Phil talked to you about the Philippines, Thailand, what's it here? They outlaw, essentially, at the moment, as of 2022, cryptocurrency exchanges and other kind of institutional players, so CFIs essentially. But they do allow tacitly DeFi's, decentralized platforms, so peer-to-peer essentially, without a middleman to handle it. Vietnam allows citizens to hold virtual assets, but it doesn't recognize cryptocurrency as legal tender. So that's a key bit, right? Can I exchange Bitcoin? One Bitcoin equals X US dollars, or one Bitcoin equals X Vietnamese
dollars. They got Bitcoin ATMs in Vietnam, in Saigon. They have them. They have them at like in Famulao and Buving. They have them. They have these, like, you can just go into a store and then.
But is it operated by like a official bank?
No, I don't know who operates these machines. They're a machine. Like you type in, yeah.
You give them your digital bank,
digital
wallet.
Yeah, I've done it before. Yeah. I did it back then. Yeah, it was crazy. 2018, right before the pandemic.
I assume that's not run by one of the official banks in Vietnam. Mm.
No, but you see a huge, you know, the Bitcoin sign.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I'm saying that, that's not plugged into a one of the big banks in Vietnam.
No. Whoever's operating that is like rogue. But you see it all over like the backpacking areas. And so I don't know if they still have it though, but I remember in 2018, it was everywhere.
Here's some more facts about Vietnam. 17% of Vietnam's 97 million people own cryptocurrency.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's great penetration, right? It's used a lot for international remittances into Vietnam and outside of Vietnam. And I think they're using cryptocurrency because it's significantly cheaper. So in Vietnam, you're looking at an annual remittance volume of $3 to $3.5 billion each year.
You know, I have a question for you on, and this is like such a basic, ignorant, you know, could be very ignorant, but I have a feeling that the United States and the Western countries approach taxation in a very serious way. When I think about Southeast Asia, I think like property tax, right? There's no property tax. And there's no real tax collected in a very official way that they do here. Is that because it's a relaxed attitude, or do you think it's robust institutional sort of like they don't have the resources to kind of implement this and the expertise?
I think there's a lot more documentation in the US and Australia and Britain and Western countries, right? Documentation. Everything you do is documented, right? So that implies that there's evidence of things, right? So it's easier to see what you did and therefore tax what you did, right? So, for example, if you talk about building a house, you'll need to get building permits. So there's an official record of how many square foot or square meters your house is. If it's property tax, then they go to that kind of
They have record. That in Vietnam. They have the Soda, which is the red deed. They have it. But
is there a link between the land office and the tax office, for example?
No, I don't know. That I don't know.
That's a
question.
But right?
I wonder, is it a cultural thing? Because if they started doing that, they would actually, in essence, make more money as a country if they did it.
Yeah. So there's that. There's also corruption as well. And let's speak to that, right? It's arguable that there is slightly more corruption in Southeast Asian countries than in, let's say, the US or other Western countries, arguably. Well,
I bring that up because when I think about property taxes and actual official taxation, it's very similar to like the Bitcoin or cryptocurrency situation. They don't really think about like the actual capital gain side that Southeast Asian countries.
But there's an income tax we haven't talked about either, which I just looked up. It's 35% progressive income tax.
In Vietnam?
In Vietnam. But 20% if you're not a resident.
Like, yeah, it's very similar to America.
Very similar. It's so funny because that's a communist, communist tax rate. It's actually more aggressive in France. In a
40-50%.
45% if you make, you know, six figures.
The US used to have a 95% tax rate, maximum marginal tax rate.
That's crazy, yeah. But that was for like a certain tax bracket, right? Like
That's a top marginal tax bracket.
Yeah. But that was during the war years, though.
Even before the war years, it was very high.
So how good is the Vietnamese government, for example, on chasing down a lack of paying taxes on crypto exchanges, right? Probably not that, like, they probably don't care.
You need to have the people, the expertise, the systems and the protocols in place in order to enforce.
By contrast, if the IRS in the US audits you, they can look at your crypto wallets. I just looked it up. They can actually see if you've paid taxes on crypto, which is a good advisory to anyone that's not reporting.
Yeah, but I think that's after 2019. Because anything before 2019, they couldn't. There was no regulatory sort of commissions. They just didn't. I mean, we moved hundreds of thousands of dollars in our crew, and nobody filed for that.
No, I mean, it's impossible for anybody to track it. Because Binance shut down. It's impossible to retrieve any of this information. And there were other exchanges that we used that doesn't exist anymore.
I guess, yeah.
Silence. Silence.
I mean, 5 years ago, I think you're outside of the...
statute of limitations.
Yeah. I'm kind of silent because I used to do taxes.
Look.
And all no, I think it's safe to say most people are not paying any taxes on their crypto that they're moving in Southeast Asia. I mean, maybe that's a bullshit.
Yeah, they're not.
But I don't think
they're not. And I don't think that the regulatory bodies in Southeast Asia, well, maybe not Singapore, but like Vietnam, Indonesia, I don't think they think about it. Or they do, but they're just like, culturally, we are just not taxation people. Like, we don't do that. We don't go hard like that. Your money is your money. But I think in America and the Western countries, it's like, wait a minute. You are living in a very privileged society. You need to pay your taxes. You need to pay your dues. It's like, it's...
Greece is kind of exempted from Western democracies in that regard.
In Greece, a Western democracy?
Yeah. Yes. I don't think they invented, they may have invented the tax department. I'm not too sure.
But you know what I'm saying? It's like, I feel like culturally, and I don't want to be generalizing, but I think Southeast Asia, the taxes are just not the same as the West.
It's not top of mind.
It's not. Yeah. It's not.
Is that because enforcement's not as regular?
That's why I'm asking severe? You. I don't know.
So I used to work in Australian tax, corporate tax. Each year we would have a new copy of the taxation laws delivered to us on our desks. Every taxation accountant, taxation lawyer would have it. They were basically seven volumes, I think, and about half a meter, which is about 2.5 feet, worth of tissue paper. So you think wrapping paper or tissue paper? That's how thin the paper each page was.
But let me ask you this, like, in America, we always, like, there's always this thing you hear, I'm a tax-paying person. You hear the pride in somebody saying that. Oh, you can't mess with me. I pay my taxes, right? Yeah. It's a big, you never hear that in Vietnam.
In Greece.
Or Greece.
But what about Australia?
Do you?
Australia, you have to.
No. But do you say it with pride? Like, it's a thing here. I think in America, it's a thing we say.
America's got a pride in very strange things.
Yeah.
Very strange thing.
Yeah, I think in socialist countries it's less of a proud thing. It's more of like an
I got forced.
Obligation.
Yeah.
No, I don't think it's like this is I'm just doing.
I'm
a functional human.
I think are you saying that, and I think this is what you're suggesting, but you don't want to say it out loud, is that in Southeast Asian countries people take pride in not paying tax.
I think.
Is that what you're saying, Ken?
I wouldn't stop you from accusing me of that, but I'm not directly saying it. I just
explains why, like,
yeah, you know, I just don't
swatches of you know why Little Saigon is sort of red basically, why it's conservative, right?
Yeah,
why certain people would side with a party that's into less
taxes. and this is what you're saying explains the rapid adoption of cryptocurrency in Southeast Asia. It's this general attitude towards,
look, here's the problem.
Mine is mine, not the government's.
Here's the problem with what I'm saying. There's no way to fact check it. There's no way to research what I'm saying. It's just an observation, right? There's no way. I'm just really talking out of my ass right now because there's no way that you can functionally prove right or wrong what I'm saying. I'm just saying from a very young age, I just never heard anybody really figuring out their taxes in Vietnam.
Go ahead.
Yeah. In America, it's like every year, at the end of the year, beginning of the year, you are...
There's a ritual.
There's a ritual. You prepare to submit and pay.
Australia is pretty smart, and they just... It's like nothing's like a big deal there, it feels like. Like, it just says basically that crypto assets in Australia are taxed as CGT assets, which are...
Capital gains tax.
Capital gains. And there's basically like self... that's including sort of self-managed funds, and they're just part of your normal ordinary
basket.
Income tax.
Yeah.
You made some money in crypto. That's part of your income tax.
You're reading from the IRS, US IRS. It sounds, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's the same playbook.
Yeah, but it's just really, that just seems really basic.
Let me clarify what Phil said, because there's a difference between ordinary income and capital gains, right? So what Phil is saying is that in America and Australia, for example, cryptocurrency is treated like, and the US is treated like capital gains or capital gains transaction.
So this is crypto assets are treated as capital gains assets, but yeah. Your rewards, in other words, your earned income or your profits off crypto are ordinary income for tax purposes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it's really simple.
Yeah.
You made some money, pay some taxes on it.
Nope.
Right?
That's the US. They flipped it in 2019. It's like, we're not doing this. We are not going to let you get away. We are going to make you pay for taxes. But you can still get away with it, though.
If you're making, like, you know, millions in crypto, probably should pay some taxes on it now. Am I wrong to say
that? Is that a moral argument you're making there, Phil?
Maybe not, because you made it through a platform that's not beholden to your, but they are beholden to your government. You made it domestically somehow, right? No? Didn't they have to work?
Doesn't it exist in the ether? That's the whole argument.
Exactly.
Does it know if they have to work with the government and the
they made it. They forced their way into it. They forced their way into it. The U.S. government forced their way into crypto. They forced everybody to convert. They shut down Binance. You can't operate that website in America. You can't operate that app in America. Binance used to be all over the world. You could just hop on it and trade. And then once you trade money, you trade it for USDT. USDT could be converted into money, to dollars.
So one of the things about the US tax system is it has a very strong extraterritoriality reach. So in America, if you're subject to American tax, if you're a US tax resident, for example, you are taxed on both income and capital gains that you make in the US, as well as income you make outside of the US. So that's how they captured Binance, for example. Because even though Binance would say, hey, you know, we're in the ether somewhere, right? But for a US corporation or US individual who does in Binance or cryptocurrency, they're taxed on worldwide income. So that's how they get captured. Other countries don't have that kind of reach in their tax systems.
Yeah.
Australia does. Very similar to America.
You know, I think every year we should visit cryptocurrency in Southeast Asia, and we should start really tracking it, you know, because I think it's extraordinary.
It's rapidly changing.
Yeah. And I think that's why every year we should visit, every six months.
It's kind of somewhat interesting. It's rapidly changing, but it's not so rapidly changing.
Right. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think the governments are still taking a hodgepodge, kind of cautious approach across the Southeast Asia region. Just like with any new technology, there's rapid adoption by certain peoples, right? And I think there is this tension, like you say, between corporations and other stakeholders in cryptocurrency versus central banks, for example. Central banks are there for the long term, right? They're looking after the sovereign interests of their citizens and whatnot. So they're looking for stability in the banking system. Cryptocurrency tries to usurp this and say, hey, we're innovative, we're fast moving and things like that. But that poses a threat to the banking system of every country, right? And so there's this tension that needs to be resolved by the central banks, essentially. One way is just through regulation, the other way is through the taxation system.
Would you, one of you, like to close off the episode today? Wrap it up.
What did you think you learned, Ken?
For me, I think that we got into something that is something that we need to look at, which is culturally. There's two things that I learned today came from you, Phil, which is the inverse ratio between countries with high GDPs versus low GDP and their relationship to cryptocurrency. Right, that's one thing that I think we can dedicate like a whole other part two to this and say, why is that, right? As it relates to Southeast Asia. And then the second thing I think we kind of got into is this idea of, as a country,
taxation and the lack of taxation in Southeast Asia, and the their gravitation towards cryptocurrency as a result of like not really being into taxation.
Yeah.
From my perspective, I'm just interested in the hodgepodge of approaches by regulators within Southeast Asia.
That's fascinating.
Vis-a-vis, cryptocurrency and exchanges. Two, it's interesting that Southeast Asia, or Asia in more generally, contributes about a third of the software developers that are involved in cryptocurrency.
Wow. Right?
So that's amazing.
Cheap labor.
Yeah, and that's, you know, contrast that with the environmental impacts of cryptocurrency. That's kind of interesting.
And exploitation.
Yeah. And then the other thing too for me is, in terms of exploitation, it's like, will financial education and literacy improvements, will it be enough to kind of... force field smaller people, you know, the mom and pops of the world, against the vagaries of cryptocurrency. You know, is it a combination of a much stronger and more stringent regulation and enforcement by central banks, plus education by exchanges like Bitcoin or Coinbase, that will help give more a surety to the mom and pops of the world? That's what I'm really concerned about, because we all have relatives back at home, right? In Southeast Asia and elsewhere, where you don't want your granny to lose her life savings.
Well, I think, like I said, I think this deserves a part two. Not anytime soon. I think we should revisit this, next year.
Cool. Yeah. Sounds good.
Wonderful. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Cheers. Yeah.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.